From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This nation looked very different in the weeks after 9/11 and the terrorist attacks. American flags waved from every post. Churches, mosques, and synagogues were filled to the rafters. President Bush went on national television and declared war on terror. 1 year later, how different are we, really? Sure, there are longer lines at the airport, but what about deep at the nation's core? Has America reinvented itself in the face of a terrorist threat? Tonight, we wade into that question with editor-at-large of Time magazine, Michael Elliott, and conservative journalist Andrew Sullivan. Their dueling essays in this week's Time debate the question, has America changed? Have you seen fundamental change in the way this country sees itself and its position in the world since 9/11? Was that change inevitable? Is it good? Or is sticking with America's traditional values of openness and engagement the only way to keep terrorists from really winning? Is that the way we're going? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin the hour with Time magazine's Michael Elliott joining us from Bronxville, New York. Good evening and welcome, Michael Elliott.
Good evening to you. Pleasure to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. With me here in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Elliott.
Hi, Jack.
Michael Elliott, you take the side in the standoff in the magazine this week, opposed from Yes, America Has Changed, which is Andrew Sullivan's line. Yours is No, America Has Not, and Thank God. What's the case that you make that, fundamentally, the United States is not a changed country 1 year on?
I think I'd answer that question in two ways. First off, by comparing 9/11 and its aftermath with events that really were epochal in the way in which they changed either American society on the one hand or America's role in the world on the other hand. And the two that I chose were, first of all, World War II as an exemplar of change in American society. And secondly, the Cold War in terms of a change in America's posture in the world. Now, if you take World War II, this was a period in which 12 million men were conscripted into the armed services. Mm-hmm. 300,000 died. You had massive changes in terms of the social position of women. You had the first cracks in the evil carapace of legal racial segregation. You had possibly the greatest technological pace of innovation that the world has ever known, quite literally. Mm-hmm. You had the development of weapons that could snuff out life on Earth. And last but by no means least, in the war's aftermath, you had the GI Bill, probably the most successful piece of legislatively mandated social engineering that this or any other country has done. Which was essential to the creation of a post-war mass middle class.
And you put all of that up against the changes post 9/11 and say, in your first example here, there's no comparison in the degree of change.
Absolutely. To an extent, I'm surprised by that, I should say. One of the things that I've been doing, particularly this year, since January this year, is speaking whenever I could to schools and colleges, to students in high schools or in colleges. And I've continually asked them to see if they can specify for me the way their lives might be different from the way they were before 9/11. And I should say at the outset that my experiences with these kids has been absolutely fantastic. Highly intelligent, tremendously engaged, really well informed about issues going on in the world.
And do their child's eyes see a change?
Desperate to know more. And yet, very few of them have indicated to me that that they think America has changed. One of the things that I say in the article is that if we had really expected true change to have taken place, in the United States, two indicators, I think, would have flashed red. The first is church attendance. I attend church regularly. Everyone knows that in the first couple of weeks after 9/11, the churches were full. But if you go to church regularly, I think you know that now they're back to where they were in August last year.
And why do you see that as such a significant indicator?
Because I think that if 9/11 had had a major change in social mores in the United States, one would have expected... I mean, after all, this was an act of unbelievable mass murder. Mm. And it touched us to our core. And I'm certainly not... I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not diminishing the emotion with which we felt the tragedy. But if there'd really been a substantial change in our deep structure, if you like, I would have expected to see it manifested in church attendance.
We could debate that, and maybe we will, but you had another indicator you were looking at.
The second one is enlistment in the armed forces. The Pentagon are quite open about this. In the immediate aftermath of September the 11th, there was a near doubling of the expressions of interest by young Americans in careers in the armed forces. But that has not translated into any discernible uptick in actual enlistment in the armed forces.
So this is not like the old scenes in the Civil War movies of young men crowding into enlistment centers to join the war.
It absolutely is not. It absolutely is not.
Maybe, Michael Elliott, it's more like the Cold War. That's an analogy that's more often drawn, that it's long and gray and without end or visible end. What do you make of that contrast or comparison?
Well, there, I think, the key question to ask is, will the war on terrorism that follows 9/11 have the same effect as on American foreign policy as the Cold War did? Can it be spoken of in the same breath? I just don't think it can. The Cold War was a 40-year struggle against an enemy that was bristling with weapons of mass destruction, with nuclear weapons, aimed directly at us, pointed directly at us. That enemy had an ideology with many adherents and many apologists in the West. And an ideology, moreover, that was extending its reach in the developing world, you know, as late as the mid-1980s. And for 40 years, we completely restructured our foreign policy to contest the power of Soviet communism wherever it showed itself, from Vietnam to the backlots of Hollywood, if you like.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. Michael Elliott looks at these two examples and says, nothing that has happened since September 11th suggests that it will mark so profound a change in American society. But let's look at the Cold War example for a moment. I mean, obviously, it's too soon to know how many years this new war, if it's appropriate to call it that, will go on, though Washington says it will go on a long, long time. Can we be so sure yet? Are the early indicators as clear to you that this war on terror, call it what you will, may not be as consequential, at least, as the Cold War, ultimately?
I think it remains to be seen, because the main difference between what happened, to go back to World War II, Michael's example, and now, is that in World War II, I think four bombs were dropped on this country. One was by a pontoon plane from a Japanese submarine that flew over the Oregon coast in early 1942 and dropped, I think, two bombs. And then the other, I think a couple of bombs, were, as David Kennedy shows in Freedom from Fear, while the Enola Gay was flying to Hiroshima to drop the atomic bomb, the Japanese released incendiary devices, tiny incendiary devices on small parachutes, and set them up into the jet stream, and the Enola Gay and the incendiary devices crossed midair, and those devices, some of them came down in Oregon and in Montana and started a little fire.
But all essentially inconsequential.
That was it.
World War II.
And we didn't have what we had. The homeland, in fact, the word didn't exist until it was menaced. Now, Does that make some profound difference? I think the answer is we don't know. We do know that that is a fair, you know, as history goes, that's as close to being unprecedented as you can be in the modern age, and the psychological ramifications of that and the differences it may make in American policy, it seems to me, are incalculable. And one thing, clearly, one big change has come out of that. For the first time, this country has adopted a strike-first, preemptive doctrine that we are not going to wait for dangers to gather. We're going to strike before they manifest themselves. I don't know that we've ever had anything like that in our history. Some people looking at that would say that's a formula for aggressive war. We've never had that before.
Michael Elliott, does that constitute a major change? And how, what parallel would you draw to the kind of situation we're in now, the kind of conflict we're in now, if you don't see it as a change on the scale that World War II or the Cold War wrought?
Well, you know, like all of us, I guess, I'm a kind of historian monkey, and, you know, everyone kind of chooses their own analogy. The analogy I like is one that I don't think is kind of often used or understood, and that is the long and messy and highly contingent, in some ways, 50-year struggle to end the Atlantic slave trade in the first half of the 19th century.
This is before the Civil War, when this was
before
an effort not of the United
I mean,
States, but of Great Britain.
Essentially from 1812 to the 1860s.
Mm-hmm.
This was an effort that involved lots and lots of different countries, though the strike force, as it were, tended to be the Royal Navy, with the British Royal Navy, which had a squadron based off West Africa and another in the Caribbean.
It's an obscure reference to a lot of us. What are the parallels that you see? What was the nature of that conflict that
because
you see in this conflict?
It was long. It was a war that was a priority for many nations, but which defined the national interest of none. It was a war waged not just with the occasional use of force, but also by means of economic development, multilateral diplomacy, the occasional use of bribes. And it was a war fought for a high moral purpose, and certainly the war against terrorism.
But it didn't threaten downtown London.
No, it didn't threaten downtown London. And I wanted to get back to Jack's point, because a lot has been made of the fact that 9/11 was an attack on the homeland as being a distinguishing feature of our present condition from anything that has gone before. And, of course, it is. I mean, you know, one can't wish that away if you're on my side of the debate. It is different. On the other hand, you know, think of World War II. Sure, there wasn't an attack on the homeland. There were 300,000 dead Americans.
Mm-hmm.
300,000, you know. No town, no village, no suburb, untouched by death. And it is correct to say that 9/11 was unprecedented in terms of bringing a war to territory that was identifiably part of the United States. So I dare say our friends in Hawaii would have something to say about that. But it is manifestly not correct to say that the scale of mayhem and agony on 9/11 was unprecedented, because we have lost many, many, many more people than we lost on 9/11 in long and bitter wars.
So what is the change, Michael Elliott, that you, when you say, no, we haven't changed, thank God, what are you thanking God for there exactly? What change are you happy hasn't been made? What constant are you happy to find?
Well, here, of course, you know, one has to kind of make the usual columnist's plea that we do not write our own headlines.
Fair enough.
But it's a, you ask a good question. I think the United States showed itself after 9/11 to be what the United States has always shown itself to me as a, you know, long-term immigrant, and that's a country of tremendous resourcefulness, of compassion, of determination, of grit, of love and generosity. But none of that was invented on September the 12th. And none of it was in abeyance, as some people, I think rather foolishly, seem to argue, in the 8 years before.
Michael Elliott, if you can hold it right there, we've got to take a break. We're going to come right back and hear a sharply opposing view from Andrew Sullivan, and we're interested in your view as well. Has America been fundamentally changed by 9/11? Should it be? Is terrorism more or less threatening to the United States than Nazi Germany and global communism? Has the dream of the new world, apart and exempt from the hatreds of the old world, been ended? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about whether America has been fundamentally changed by 9/11 and its aftermath, and in a sense, whether it should be. What do you think? Are we a different people nearly 1 year on? Should we be? If we are not exceptional anymore, not the city on the hill, what are we? What do you think? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking with Michael Elliott, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, who wrote one half of the argument in this week's issue of that magazine. Have we changed? He said no, and thank God. On the opposite page, Andrew Sullivan, joining us now from Provincetown, Massachusetts, wrote the opposite. Yes, America has changed, he says. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Sullivan.
Good evening.
You? We're very well, thanks, and it's good to have you back with us again. You know Michael Elliott's argument. You've read it. Please give us your case. The United States has changed and changed profoundly. How so?
Well, I think in many ways I agree with Michael, of course. You know, the fundamental character of the United States and of Americans remains the same. It can sometimes be obscured when we all get caught up in trivial events, but then when something like 9/11 happens, it kind of rips off the surface, and you see that the amazing resources of compassion and grit and patriotism and everything else that's there beneath the surface. But I think the concept of America has to have changed, and for a very simple reason, really, that for the first time, really, since the Revolutionary War, there really was a foreign power that came in and attacked the United States in the homeland. And not only that, but eagerly pronounces daily that it wants to do it again.
And you write that the consequence of that is that, and I quote you here, the illusion of American exceptionalism has been shattered. The whole dream of this continent, that it was a place where you could safely leave the old world and its resentments behind, was ended that day. That sounds like a big, big change.
It was a big change. It is a big change. And I don't think that we are going to easily forget it. You know, other countries are used to massive wars that actually impact their very existence, whether it's the Soviet Union, the Second World War, or Nazi Germany, or Britain that was nearly overwhelmed in 1940, or France, which has been invaded, or Japan. Any of these countries is used to the war coming to the homeland, but not the United States until last year. And now we're aware of that. We're aware that we are vulnerable to that, and that these people who wish us ill and want to destroy the civilization that is the West are out there now trying to get us still, operating in countries around the world, and as part of a mass movement in the Middle East that aims to bring down the United States explicitly. And indeed, the whole concept of separation of church and state, civil rights, basic freedoms, the whole concept that the West is built on is now explicitly under attack.
But you're describing there first an event on 9/11, an attack, and then circumstances of threat that ensue from that. Where do you find the change there? A nation could conceivably face all that and decide not to change.
Well, it can't not change if it's going to meet that external threat. And clearly, in the last year, we've had quite significant changes in terms of the projection of American force abroad. We've also seen an extraordinary shift in American foreign policy from one that says we're just going to wait until we get attacked and have self-defense to one that says we're not going to wait anymore. We're going to have a preemptive foreign policy which sees the threats emerging and seeks to get rid of them before they gain strength enough to hit us again. And that's what the whole Afghanistan campaign was about. That is what the Iraq campaign is about. And I think that will just be part of a continuing war which will involve this country for the foreseeable future.
Do you think that constitutes a fundamental change in America's understanding of itself, of its values, of its place in the world?
Yes, because isolationism was always an option until now. Even even with the Soviet Union or with Hitler, there was a sense that the United States had there was Fortress America, that you'd come here and not be threatened by those forces. Yes, we could go abroad and get ourselves involved in it to prevent Nazi Germany taking over, the Soviet Union taking over, but we didn't actually have to defend ourselves in the way that we have to now. And I think that not the entire American character, obviously, but that's a pretty fundamental part of the American psyche. It's why people came here and became Americans for 200 years, was to get away from that. And now it's been brought home to this place as well. As I said, about a year ago, it was once a new world, and now it's just the world. And that is a huge and, I think, terribly sad and tragic event, but it inevitably changes our view of the world for now and the indefinite future.
Michael Elliott, please respond. Andrew Sullivan says that we now see radical Islam intending to attack and destroy the very principles of the Enlightenment that underpin the American experiment, and that means, whether we're conscious of it or not, we have changed.
Well, of course, I knew the problem with this this evening's discussion was going to be that Andrew and I were going to end up agreeing because his essay in Time This Week was an absolutely wonderful statement of the opposite case, and a lot in it with which I certainly agreed. There was one.
Now wait a minute. Are you telling me that you've written that it hasn't been such a big change, and that's good? But you can easily take under your wing the notion that all of Western civilization is under attack, and that's no problem. That's not impetus to change.
That's the point on which I was searching for creative disagreements as Andrew was talking, and that's actually the point that I want to zero in on. Andrew used the phrase, I'm paraphrasing a little here, that in 9/11 we were under attack by a foreign power. Now that is one view, and there are very respectable scholars of Al Qaeda and terrorism and modern Islam and what have you, who take the view that's what 9/11 was. It was as it were, in new guise, an old-fashioned attack by a foreign power. And moreover, a powerful power, and a power that's kind of growing in influence and growing in its ability to do evil.
And it's not merely a rival for power, as Andrew Sullivan describes it, but a cultural rival that wants, as he would have it, that wants to snuff out the West.
And I'm in the school of thought, for better or worse, who has been convinced that actually radical Islam is a power on the wane, that this was, if not the last thrashing of a dinosaur, because plenty more people are going to get killed before radical Islam is finally extirpated, if you like. But I've been convinced from the people that I've spoken to that radical Islam is not best seen as a foreign power determined to do us down, but actually as a force that's on the wane in the Islamic world, less significant than it was in Algeria, less significant than it was in Egypt, and that although there are undoubtedly aspects of Al-Qaeda that distinguish them from political terrorist groups like ETA or the IRA, we should not think that we cannot defeat them in the same way in which we the West, have defeated other terrorist groups.
Well, easy to say, but meanwhile, we see President Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney effectively reconstructing American foreign policy around what looks, what was clearly a war in the making on Iraq and maybe a much wider war than that. We're talking tonight about how much and whether America has been fundamentally changed by 9/11. We know that it matters. We're sorting out exactly how. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just wanted to pose an observation. I think Mike and Andrew have excellent speculations, but Jack has the final word when he says that it's too early to make that decision. A dynamic, fundamental change. We won't know that for at least another 10 years altogether. We'll see several changes along the way, but are they going to be fundamental? Too hard to say. What I'd like to put out and hear everyone's comments on are right after 9/11, when it was being compared to something on the level of Pearl Harbor, there was a moment or a period where Americans were looking for what to do. Should we mobilize? You know, do they want us to, mm-hmm. to ration supplies? And the administration made a point of telling everyone to go about business as usual. Don't change your habits. Go out, keep the economy going, keep spending, go out to the parks. I can almost hear President Bush on the television and radio.
We all remember.
So I'd like to put out that to Pearl Harbor, our reaction was to mobilize. For 9/11, it seems as if our strategy is to stay unchanged, to try and keep things as usual.
Well, that was the message at some level, but I wonder if that's the whole message. Steve, but thank you for your comment and your call. Jack Beatty, let me put it to you. How do you see the U.S. leadership today framing this issue of change? Are we not being told both things simultaneously? Go shopping, live your regular life, and it's a whole new world.
Yeah. During World War II, a British diplomat flying west, somewhere over the Midwest on a plane, the stewardess gave him his pat of butter, and he scooped the butter out, and he put it on the bread. And sure enough, at the bottom of the pat, it said, remember Pearl Harbor.
Even there.
The ubiquity and centrality and hauntingness of that hung over the whole country and helped to mobilize it. But, you know, we ask ourselves with things like this, you know, what is it that fixes meaning? And when people said, remember Pearl Harbor, what was it they were remembering? Well, in retrospect, we think it means the end of American isolationism, that we accepted we had to be involved in the world. We had cut out of the League of Nations, and look what happened. But to Americans right after Pearl Harbor in the election of 1942, practically everyone identified as an isolationist whose worldview presumably was repudiated by Pearl Harbor was reelected, and handsomely. So people remembered it for different things. And so when we look at 9/11, do we remember it as a bolt from the blue from people who hate us for our values, for our freedom, as the president says? Oh, do we see it as do we remember 9/11 as the, you know, tragic backfiring of our foreign policy, of specifically our efforts to whip up a holy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan and our decision to base forces in Saudi Arabia? Do we remember the surge of national solidarity after the trauma? Or do we remember a security and intelligence failure our leaders would like us to forget? Do we remember the triumph over the Taliban, or do we remember the Afghan civilians we killed in the triumph? Do we remember, you know, that we discovered a troubled world, or that we're sort of understanding the world and all its complexities? Or do we remember the beginning of an American unilateralism that says, no, the world is this way or that way? So I think it's up the legacy and meaning of 9/11 is by no means clear. And
of course, I think Jack is
Andrew Sullivan.
I think Jack is absolutely right about that. It's too early. But there's another paradox here, it seems to me, that the more successful we are in the war on terror, the fewer terrorist incidents there will be, and therefore the less the sense that we need a war on terror. It is a war that will, in terms of public opinion, constantly undermine itself. Insofar as if it is successful, it will lead to its own abolition.
Does that in itself, Andrew Sullivan, mean that the change is self-limiting? Because the more successful it is, the less change.
I think it is, unless we have real leadership to tell us just because we haven't had a strike doesn't mean we aren't in danger. We didn't think we were in danger September 10th, but we were. And I think that requires the kind of political leadership that was really extremely hard to find and would really require a quite elaborate rhetorical and ideological skills. I'm not sure, although I'm an admirer of this president, that he quite has that, because otherwise it will come back to bite us. I think that Jack's right. We need time to see how this will play out. But at some level, at the same time, I do think that we will at some point in the future say, remember 9/11. We will remember it. The question is, of course, what for?
And interestingly, how that hasn't been fully framed by our leadership as yet. Paul's on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, listen to it. Andrew seems to have it right, and I lean towards that. But one thing I find that's interesting is that I think things have changed, but they really haven't hit home yet.
How so? Or what's missing?
I'll give you an example, which actually happened today. I work at MIT, and there's a scientist came up to me and said, geez, look at my grad student. You know, he's stuck in China. And I understand that there's about 60 other students. They're all stuck all over the world because they can't come back in the country.
Because immigration has become tougher since 9/11.
So I said, well, and he starts complaining about this, that, and the other thing. And I go, you know, there's a war on. And I says, well, you know, it might not be hitting home to us, but it's certainly starting to hit home to these people. So my point here is that, yes, there's a war on, but it hasn't hit home yet to folks. And I think, listening to what's been happening lately in the news, that maybe it will be more so in the next couple of weeks when we start dealing with the Iraq issue.
Mm, but you raise a very interesting point. Andrew Sullivan, let me put it to you. You raise this hugely consequential vision of Western civilization itself under attack. Does that necessarily mean that America has changed? Paul's looking at his immediate circumstance and finding people who don't really seem to have taken that on board. Has it really changed? And How do you want it to change? If it's all under attack, are you saying you want this to become a bunker nation? What does it suggest?
No, this is another paradox. Of course, we're fighting for the right to be free to live normal, boring, regular, wonderful, not-so-wonderful lives in a free society. But the enemies of freedom are still around. And what they're trying to do is, in fact, take away our ability to live normal, boring, fun lives, to be watching American Idol right now rather than talking about Iraq. But the truth is that we have to keep both in perspective. We have to both keep our vigilance in order to have a free society. And I think that Michael made a very good point. Maybe radical Islam is on the wane. But my feeling is that a lot of that will depend on whether we prove to the world that we really are serious about defending our freedoms and our way of life, which means we're not going to tolerate people like Saddam Hussein funneling potentially weapons of mass destruction to terrorist groups. We're not going to sit around and let that happen anymore. And I think that if we do succeed in getting rid of that monster and removing that threat from the world, then I think that we might have a domino effect of some of these radical regimes and some of these Islamist fanatics actually losing ground in the Arab and Muslim world and being marginalized as they should. I think we can win. I think the threat can disappear. At the same time, I think if we do nothing, then the threat will only grow.
And you suggest it's enormous. You suggest it's even somehow more lethal than Nazi Germany and Communist Russia. That sounds like a world-changing threat indeed.
Well, if a biological weapon is let off in Los Angeles or San Francisco by a small cell of these people, it surely will. We will, you know, and there is no reason actually, you know, militarily or psychologically why that cannot or will not happen. And I think when that happens, we're going to have another. And if that happens, I mean, God forbid, but if it does, then I don't think we're going to be having this discussion. We'll realize the war absolutely is here. And it is, just because it's not as clearly identifiable as like a state, like the Soviet Union or like Nazi Germany, doesn't mean it isn't as dangerous.
It isn't happening. Andrew Sullivan, I know we have to lose you. Thanks for being with us. Michael Elliott, please hold on. Andrew Sullivan writes daily on his website, andrewsullivan.com. His essay in the current issue of Time magazine is entitled, Yes, America Has Changed. He's a senior editor at New Republic. Listeners, have we fundamentally changed? Has trauma brought out the best in us or the worst? Do we know yet? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A week from the anniversary of 9/11, we're asking tonight whether America has been fundamentally changed by the events of September 11th, 2001. And maybe, should it be? Has the dream of the new world, apart and exempt from the hatreds of the old, been ended? Have Americans become, in their hearts, like the rest of the world, vulnerable, consumed with threats? Do we believe that all we value, freedom of religion, of conscience, of tolerance, secularism, is all that under attack? Have we fundamentally changed since 9/11? We're joined tonight by Michael Elliott, editor-at-large at Time magazine, and happy that we have him still on because a lot of people want to talk to him. Michael, thanks for being with us. I want to turn to our callers. Mark is calling from Genoa, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've actually been quite interested and even a little bit disturbed by the lack of cultural change in the country.
In what respect?
Well, I remember a few days after 9/11, I was getting my hair cut, and I had a few minutes in the barbershop, And I was looking through various magazines, and I was struck by how juvenile most of the media coverage was, including, you know, in our supposed news magazines. And here we are almost a year later, and you take a look at the coverage that's in the media, and we're worried about Brad Pitt's beard, whether Julia Roberts is having an affair.
Well, but isn't that the dust of culture that's always floating around, Mark? I mean, even in wartime, we paint, you know, cheesecake girls on the sides of jet fighters.
But what I see is I don't see any of the other. You know, it just seems to be a preoccupation with a very silly aspect of culture. There's no sense of personal sacrifice. We've got corporate mm-hmm. terrorists who are causing a lot more damage to people at home than the terrorists overseas. Nothing's happening there. You said a moment ago mm-hmm. you're talking about a nation that believes in personal liberties and so on. And yet, you know, we've had things like the Patriot Act, which have really undermined those freedoms. And yet I don't see among people themselves, at least from my perspective, much concern, much even awareness of what's going on, rather mm. preoccupation with
the trivial.
With the toys.
Mark, we've got your angle, and thanks for bringing it to us. Michael Elliott, what about it? We hear you agreeing to some extent with Andrew Sullivan that there's a real threat to many things that Americans value here. On the other hand, in some dimension, you're celebrating a lack of change. Is it possible we have not changed enough?
Oh, no. I mean, I couldn't disagree more with the last caller, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one of the great things about America is our ability to celebrate Brad Pitt's beard. And thank God we can. There is no righteousness in unnecessary solemnity. And I'm delighted that a year after the Summer of the Shark, we can have, you know, the Summer of Ozzy Osbourne or whatever the heck has been absorbing people. I don't think that... I mean, I think what happened in 9/11 is serious. I think many of Andrew's points are absolutely right. Radical Islamic terrorism is a serious threat. It needs to be uprooted. There's a serious job to be done. But we don't have to kind of cloak ourselves in solemnity to do it. That's not to kind of use a cliched phrase, that's not what we're fighting for.
Brad Pitt's beard. Hold on, Michael. I want to put it to Jack Beatty. Jack Beatty, I'm starting to get a slightly schizophrenic feeling here. On the one hand, we've got a threat to the very survival of the Western civilization and all that's ensued from the Enlightenment. On the other hand, you know, we're fighting for Brad Pitt's beard, or we should embrace continuity.
Yeah.
Which is it? Can it be both?
I think it has been both, and in some ways, what we're analogous to the period of the phony war, from September again, 1939, to the spring of 1940, when the German armies were behind their border and the French armies were behind their border, and Poland had fallen, but thus far nothing had befell the Western Front. And, you know, you read accounts of the French Third Republic. There were scandals. There were the corruption of this regime, and
yeah.
People lived a high life, and it went on and on. But boy, when that second strike came in May of 1940. Everything changed.
But Michael Elliott says another strike comes, there's no Nazi juggernaut buried in this threat.
Well,
Michael Elliott.
I actually don't think that this is a clash of civilizations. I mean, I think Andrew's not here anymore, but I mean, I think this is a point at which probably he and I disagree. I mean, I don't think that the threat from Islamic radical extremism is a real one and a dangerous one. It's one we should take seriously. It's one we should contest seriously. I do not myself believe that it is on the level of the sort of threat to be faced from communism and fascism. That's my view. It seems to me that it's something that we can handle. It's something that we can deal with. It's something whose power, I believe, is on the wane. And there will be more deaths and there will be more attacks. But I think you can give the terrorists too much credit.
Michael, let's grab a couple more calls. Rob's calling from Radisson, Wisconsin. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and hello, your guests. I feel that we have most definitely changed.
In what respect?
We've become much more warlike. And I think that's very evident in the fact that just days and weeks after, people of Middle Eastern descent were actually knocked down on the street and run over by vehicles and killed. In addition, the Patriot Act by Mr. Ashcroft and George Bush increasing the military budget, which up to this point for last year was, I believe, $310 billion with a B, to now an additional $40 billion. Now, that $40 billion is not slated for anything in regards to terrorism. That's just an additional military-industrial complex gravy.
Rob, we got it. I want to get one more call. Bashir is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Bashir. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I just would like to tell this last caller that had he been any other place on this planet, he would have never had a moment to say what he just said.
What do you mean?
He just is saying terrorism and this and that. I mean, there is no... life has changed. If it had happened to another place, I wouldn't even be here on this phone today.
Has it changed for you, Bashir?
I have lost my actual freedom.
Why?
A sense of freedom. From the second these people, these unaware people, unconscious people came and dropped whatever mess they created, I have never had a sense of freedom from that day on. I was living in a most peaceful, most beautiful world, the world that was always trying to become more aware than ever on this earth.
And it's gone. Bashir, our time is almost gone. Michael Elliott, there's a voice that says, I cannot live in comfort any longer after 9/11, and we know that voice. Many Americans share it.
And I respect it. And plainly, you know, there are many people, either for personal reasons or for others, for whom things have changed dramatically. I just don't believe that at its root, American society has gone through a kind of wrenching transformation because of 9/11.
Who would have believed a year ago we could be saying that? Michael Elliott, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Elliott is editor-at-large, Time Magazine. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a computer-generated anthem for the world. This is On Point. Music producer John Guillou had a dream of creating a world anthem, but instead of penning it himself, he let a computer compose it. Guillou and David Cope, a computer programmer and music professor at the University of California, loaded 193 national anthems into a computer. Then they used a music intelligence program to create a high-tech world anthem amalgam. After the events of September 11th, the World Anthem Project went from a musical science experiment to a song of healing and perhaps global unity. In this radio diary, John Guillou gives the story of the World Anthem.
In 1993, Time magazine came out with a special fall issue where they had the composite face of humanity on the cover, where they took all of the physical attributes from cultures around the world and fed them into a computer program, and they came out with this composite face, which was sort of an Amerasian-looking female. Fast forward to 1996, I was working for a record label, and they were doing a compilation CD, Anthems of the World. And I realized that, wait a minute, you know, we can do this with music as well. We could actually do a composite anthem based on these common notes and tendencies of all national anthems to create a single anthem based on those common notes and tendencies and observations. It was important to me in the beginning that, first of all, the process be validated, and it was also important for me that people didn't think that it was some guy out of Colorado's interpretation of what a world anthem should sound like. So in essence, I really wanted it to write itself. I wanted all nations to be equally represented, equally observed. And so therefore, the computer process is perfect because it is unbiased and it does equally weigh out all of the signatures that were fed into it. Melodically, most national anthems are marching songs, and so for that reason, they do have some signatures in that way. As far as time, they're also typically in the key of C. Lyrically, most national anthems typically have a theme running through them. They either speak of the aesthetics of their country, they may speak about a defining moment or battle in their history. Some national anthems do speak about their wish for world peace. I've been working on this project now for 7 years, and I have actually never spoken with Professor Cope, met the man. Everything that we've always done has been over the computer, so I was not there when he, you know, hit the button. He had to send it to me, and I was actually in my garage in my car because it was the only place I had a cassette player when I heard it for the first time, and it was just such an amazing moment in my life, and it came out to be more melodic than I thought. I was thinking that it may come out somewhat sounding militant, but it didn't. It came out very beautiful and melodic. Since it's come out, many people feel that the world anthem, sort of particularly a counter message to what happened, for instance, on 9/11, and that it is a positive gesture of healing and of hope for peace in the world. And I think they understand that the world anthem is symbolically a piece of music that honors the heritage and national pride of all nations, but yet at the same time represents us all people of all nations, and that this could be something that, despite our differences in the world, that we could share in this song together. The flip side of that is that some people have felt threatened by the world anthem. These people feel that it, you know, perhaps means a one world government, insinuating that. And of course, this is not a political project. This is a musical project. What I would like to see the world anthem do is just instill a sense of peace and unity as people in the world, realizing that we do have our separate cultures and religious and political differences, but that we do also have a common human connection. The old saying is that music is the universal language, and I see no reason not to still feel that way. I think that it is, and I think that the idea that we have actually taken these common notes from all nations and created this common song is pretty profound. And I think that to use music as the universal language to connect people is a very apropos thing.
Keep working on it. John Guillot is a music producer and the conceiver and co-creator of The World Anthem. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is